From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina lawmakers continue to struggle with the best way to tax goods sold through the Internet. You'll hear a debate about their latest proposal. Members of the UNC Board of Governors raised concerns recently about efforts to keep tabs on their conversations with state lawmakers. You'll hear their objections. Legislators are looking for new ways to fight human trafficking in North Carolina. You'll hear a proposal that takes direct aim at sex trafficking. And we'll share the story of a longtime public charter school advocate who now has a more direct connection to these alternatives to traditional public schools. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
President Donald Trump has said it is a no-go for the U.S. when it comes to the Paris climate change deal, but North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper wants in. In fact, he signed a letter saying so. Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson is here to talk about this story. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
All right, so how does a governor opt into something that the president has rejected?
Well, it's kind of tough, but the basic thing is that the governor signed an open letter that was also co-signed by some 1,200 different elected officials, business leaders, university administrators, and the like, saying, well, just because the United States is not going to abide by the guidelines agreed upon by President Obama in this Paris Climate Accord with 195 other nations, we're going to do our best to achieve the same goals on our own. That's what it boils down to.
Remind us of what the Paris Climate Accord essentially says.
Well, it's basically an agreement that these nations would reduce their greenhouse gases by a certain percentage, by a certain date certain, and that would then allegedly mitigate changes in the climate over this period of time. And again, all of this stuff is very speculative, and it also depends on the willingness of everyone who agreed to the accord to actually live up to those goals. And of course, an awful lot of constitutional experts say that the United States' participation in this is tantamount to a treaty, which has to be approved by the Senate, and President Obama never submitted it to the Senate. So basically, President Trump pulled us out of an agreement that we were never in the first place.
A lot of folks, Rick, are saying that had the United States agreed to stay in, and as you mentioned, President Obama said, yes, the U.S. wants to be part of this when he was president. They're saying, look, that would have a really negative effect on the economy, essentially putting limits on energy usage, and energy is key to growth.
Right. That's right. And what it would also do is it would there are people who said it would basically put what's left of the coal industry in the United States out of business. It would require huge fines of natural gas, and it turns out that we are sitting on some pretty good natural gas reserves right now, but that it would essentially give a huge bailout to the renewable energy business, which is heavily subsidized and mandated as it is right now. And this would simply be a major form of central planning. And another aspect of the Paris Climate Accord is that the organization that would oversee the enforcement of this would be the United Nations. So there's a sovereignty issue here. We all remember the Brexit debate
right.
in the UK, and this notion of distant bureaucrats setting policy for local governments that are somehow binding, even though the people that live under that jurisdiction have no say in it. So again, this was almost entirely for show. It was entirely to make Greens happy. And President Trump very wisely said, I'm not going to have any part of this. And unfortunately, Governor Cooper has said, hey, let's get in.
So Cooper has signed the letter. What's been the reaction to him doing this?
Republicans have been pretty much furious about it. And they've just said, this is crazy and it's not binding. The general reaction to President Trump's decision, period, has been the left has been outraged. The right has said, again, we never agreed to this to begin with in any formal, enforceable way. So he simply got us out of a deal that we shouldn't have been involved in at the beginning. And this is to generate money for the Democratic Party, votes for the governor's party in the forthcoming election, whenever that may be, and to basically rile the troops, if you will.
Here's what I think is interesting and kind of has me scratching my head. If Governor Cooper is saying that he wants the state to adhere to the principles, which would be to lower greenhouse gas emissions and to help preserve the planet, and we all know the argument there, isn't the fact that he is signing the letter and thinking that this can be done without being a part of the Paris Climate Accords, doesn't that make the case that let the market work? You don't need any sort of worldwide treaty to do this if you want to try to somehow control the climate if you believe you can do that?
Well, that's part of what the Trump administration's argument has been. In fact, that the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who's a former ExxonMobil CEO, has said, my company was going to reach those targets anyway because it was in our interest economically through various things like conservation measures, transfers to new technology and things like that. And that's basically it. And what President Trump has said is that I'm going to negotiate a better deal that doesn't kill the economy. And so, yes, the governor is actually making the argument that you don't need compulsion to make this happen, that markets will make it happen. And so in some ways, going back into the accord is symbolic, but the symbolism is probably not what the governor intended it to be.
We've been talking about the politics of this, but let's talk about the actual science, because Carolina Journal has been reporting on this issue, energy issues, climate change, et cetera, for many years now. And it was interesting because when the governor signed this letter, what you did at CarolinaJournal.com and others here posted at the Locker Room blog had to do with a 2008 story, I believe, written by Carolina Journal.
That's right. Yes. In the Locker Room, Mitch Kokai pulled up a post, pulled up a story from 2008 in which our associate editor at the time, David Bass, talked to some folks who said that if even, you know, if North Carolina would have North Carolina's participation in any kind of global climate deal would have no impact on global temperatures. And in fact, they basically said if the U.S. economy shut down completely, that the major greenhouse gas emitters like China and India would overwhelm that contribution to carbon emissions within a matter of months. And so what we do at the state level here is ineffectual, other than the fact that implementing regulations like this that are mandates and that are not market-driven increase the cost of energy, make it more difficult for consumers to get the goods and services they want in a timely manner, and have and kill economic growth. And that's exactly the sort of thing you don't want to do unless you're wanting to feel virtuous about your treatment of the planet.
And that data was coming from a nonpartisan research group, and that story back from 2008. But regardless, Rick, it does make a really effective political argument. You think we're going to be hearing about this as the next election season rolls around?
Well, yeah, we will. And what we'll hear are the two contrary visions of what this all means. You will be hearing the fact that North Carolina needs to go green. It needs to do things to reduce greenhouse gas emissions because that's important for saving the climate. And on the other side, you'll hear that doesn't really make any difference as far as global temperatures are concerned. And that's what really matters, is not what the climate is in North Carolina, because North Carolina doesn't have a climate.
Right.
It's not, you know, we're not walled off somehow. So that happens. And also that these measures, if to the extent that they are imposed by government mandate, are things that hurt economic growth and employment. And the way that you get cleaner is you get richer. Then, you know, the wealth is green, and stifling the development and the formation of capital is something that's bad for the planet and bad for the environment, as well as bad for the people.
And not to mention, yeah, higher electricity bills, which I find is really counterintuitive, that folks who want to do this put on this command and control and in the process raise the the price of energy, I mean, the people that are going to suffer the most are the folks who are living on the margins.
That's the most aggressive tax you can impose, is anything that forces the rates of energy prices higher than they normally are by market through market forces.
So again, Governor Roy Cooper has signed on to this letter, as some other governors and other officials have done, saying that even though President Donald Trump has said the U.S. will not be part of the Paris Climate Change Accords, that the governor wants North Carolina to adhere to the principles. You can read all about it at carolinajournal.com, including that story from 2008 that talks about the science and North Carolina's role. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He's editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers continue to wrestle with the best way to collect taxes on sales made over the Internet. Court rulings have said that companies need to have some sort of connection or nexus to the state to be forced to collect taxes. A state Senate bill would establish that nexus for any company with gross sales of at least $100,000 or at least 200 transactions. Republican Senator Tommy Tucker explained the background of the bill.
This is for your Internet providers. It's pretty much simple. Staff and I worked on it. We copied South Dakota statute, where if you have over 100,000 in sales and over 200 transactions per year, then it is incumbent upon the Internet provider to pay the sales tax to the state.
Much of the law linked to sales tax collection dates back to a 1992 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in a case called Quill Corporation versus North Dakota. Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick asked about that case's impact on Tucker's bill.
How do you see the Quill opinion being addressed as it relates to this particular case and this provision? And likewise, I've seen quite a bit of correspondence come to me in recent days saying if we do pass this, it'll be litigated, and before it becomes even effect, we're going to be spending thousands and thousands of dollars in litigation in the court system, and it could have substantial adverse impacts upon North Carolina providers in other states. So I'm trying to reconcile all that I've read and seen in recent weeks about that.
Lots of things have changed since 1992. I do understand your concern about the litigation. For all intents and purposes, when a decision is made by Supreme Court, we need to have something on the books to begin to collect this. There have been other states that have done this, and voluntary collections have increased for them too as well. And there are some providers, sellers that are paying tax now as well in the state already.
Legislative staffer Cindy Averett offered additional information.
Those two Supreme Court cases, one from 67 and the other one from 92, the Supreme Court said that for the seller to have enough contacts with your state, it essentially required a physical presence. But it opined that the Congress had the power to change that. So as you know, every year there's usually legislation in Congress asking that they deal with this issue, but Congress has not dealt with it. And so states have increasingly began to push that envelope, hoping to get the Supreme Court to reverse that decision. And I don't disagree with you. This bill would push the limits and go beyond what Quill provided, as have at least 25 other states. This PCS even goes a little bit farther than naming the fact that if you have a certain amount of sales in the state or gross sales in the state, either by the number of transactions or the dollar amount, that you're going to be considered having enough presence in this state. Because, as you know, now to get around the sales tax laws, a lot of people will just provide a mobile phone application platform. You can be in a physical store, but yet go to some app and order the product, and because that whoever facilitated the sale of it isn't from North Carolina, there's no sales tax. So it's created a system in which your brick-and-mortar stores are collecting and others are not. So this would even go a bit farther to say that if you're a marketplace provider and you facilitate the sales by making a platform or forum available to transact it, that's going to be considered a sale subject to the state's tax as well. I don't know what the cost would be. I don't know if someone would choose to take North Carolina to court if it enacted this law, but I think it is safe to say that those old Supreme Court cases have created ways that people creatively get around the collection of the sales tax laws of the state.
You're listening to highlights from a recent legislative debate about internet sales tax collection. Senator Floyd McKissick continued to raise concerns.
At this point in time, assuming we were to move forward, I'm assuming that litigation would likely be inevitable. I mean, has any cost been determined as to what we would spend if we were trying to defend this case? We end up taking it all the way to Supreme Court. I mean, obviously, if we use the Attorney General's office, then, you know, it's no great cost to us except for the time it spends of in-house counsel. But if we use outside counsel, which I assume we might want to use, or it might be decided we would use, then that has significant implications along with the timelines. And likewise, I do get concerned not just about the litigious nature of this bill. I mean, I'm concerned about sales taxes that are lost to the state, but I'm just not sure what cool decision in place today. Why don't we just wait for some other state to get this issue before the Supreme Court rather than North Carolina taking the lead and doing it?
Senator Tommy Tucker responded.
I don't know, Senator McKissick, if I can give you any comfort level about expenditures on litigation. I do concur with you that lawyers are very, very expensive. We have, the DOR has looked at this. The Attorney General has looked at this. There is an assumption that there will probably be litigation, and the Attorney General will probably represent us in that litigation. But there are 25 other states on hold. We'll just be 26 right now. And I don't know, depends on who chooses to file a lawsuit, whether we'll be first to move forward or not. But at least we have some sort of precedent set in the state that whereby if this is overturned or should Congress change it, then we'll be in a position to collect this tax.
Republican Senator Jerry Tillman says North Carolina could be subjected to legal challenges from another source if the state takes no action.
Instead of being worried about a lawsuit out in the future, I'm worried about lawsuits from brick-and-mortar businesses who have to charge sales taxes, collect it, and remit it, and these internet companies getting away with no sales tax charge. I think I'd be filing a lawsuit if I owned one of these brick-and-mortar businesses. You're putting me at an unfair business advantage when one pays the sales, collects it, charges it, and pays it, and the other one don't. You can make your products cheaper if you don't have to collect the sales tax. I think this is a fairness issue, and I'd rather do what's right than worry about a lawsuit down the road. We're going to get plenty of lawsuits.
Republican Senator Warren Daniel asked the legislative staffer, Cindy Averett, if this change could affect people paying income tax in North Carolina.
Currently, the practice for income tax for individuals is that individuals estimate how much they've paid for out-of-state purchases, and then that's somehow calculated onto your return, and you just submit the tax based on that estimate. So if this is going to require all online retailers who have a certain threshold to collect and remit the tax, how will that interact with the current practice of the taxpayer estimating what they owe?
If a person keeps up with their internet sales and realizes that sales tax has been collected on all of them, then they could just put zero on that form. If this bill were to pass or Congress was to enact legislation that applied the sales tax, required anybody who completes a transaction to collect and remit it, then there would be no need for that use tax line.
The Democrat McKissick also had a question about existing sales tax rules.
Today, if you are offering an item for sale over the internet and this particular provider has a brick-and-mortar presence in North Carolina or some other substantial presence in North Carolina, sales taxes are already paid. Is that not correct?
If it is that brick-and-mortar that's offering it, but as I understand it, sometimes they'll offer it through a third party. So then it's not technically them offering it for sale. It's a third party facilitating it and offering it for sale. And if that third party didn't have the physical presence, then they would have alleged they don't have the responsibility to collect and remit it. So sometimes those lines get very blurry.
You've been listening to highlights from the General Assembly's ongoing debate about the best way for North Carolina to collect taxes on internet sales. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Interactions among the UNC System's Board of Governors, the university's top staffers, and the General Assembly generated debate during a recent Board of Governors meeting. It started with a proposal to force board members to report their meetings with lawmakers. Member Marty Kotis worked to kill that proposal.
My concern is making sure that we continue to cultivate a positive relationship with the General Assembly, including open dialogue. I have concerns about the risk of this one sentence kind of stifling free speech as well. I'm also concerned that it's unenforceable, and I think it sets a bad tone for the transition of the Board of Governors.
The idea also prompted a comment from Board Member Bill Webb.
I could not believe that someone had proposed that we seek the permission or obtain the permission of the chair in a committee for us to speak to our legislature.
Board Chairman Lou Bissett stepped in to clarify the proposed rule, then had an exchange with Webb.
It says Members of the Governor Board of Governors shall advise the chair of the board and the chair of the Committee on Public Affairs of the substance of their communications and interactions with members of the General Assembly concerning university affairs. So there was nothing about giving permission.
I apologize for mischaracterizing it, but I still would have had the same objection and would have thought it entirely inappropriate.
Webb followed up with concerns about top university staffers lobbying about a bill to give the university board its own staff.
It is my understanding that the general administration staff has been lobbying the legislature about whatever without consulting us. I understand from Senator Curtis that there's been extensive lobbying against that provision. I talked to Representative Fraley about that. We ought to know when they are taking positions that uniquely affect the board, and we have no idea.
Board member Tom Goolsbee, a former state senator, shared Webb's concern.
As we move forward with the board's policies, of course I would expect the president to go over and speak with the General Assembly about anything within the board's policy, within the approval of the governing board of the university system under North Carolina law. It's in the in some legislation for us to have staff members, and for anyone to be arguing against that without some consultation with the Board of Governors deeply concerns me, if indeed that's occurring. But in regards to legislative policy and what the president or any of the GA members do, of course, I would expect that, Mr. Chairman, to be in keeping with our legislative priorities and what this Board of Governors has approved, not that we have people going over arguing about whatever they would like to.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent UNC Board of Governors discussion of the ties between the board, top university staffers, and the General Assembly. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are pursuing new ways to fight human sex trafficking. During a recent news conference, they highlighted the case of trafficking survivor Joy Anderson.
I'm a survivor of human sex trafficking. I was brought to Charlotte by my traffickers. They brought a group, me and a group of girls, all around the country. Anytime there was big events or anything, we were being sex trafficked. I actually didn't even know the term sex trafficking when I was enslaved. I just thought this was just my lot in life, and so that dark and evil lifestyle is so scary, and it's, I didn't think that there would be a way out, and 3 years ago, I was in a hotel, and I remember thinking to myself, is this all that I was born for? Is this what I was made for? Is this what I have to do? And I would rather die, or will somebody help me? So in my heart and in my mind, I went into the bathroom in the hotel and I just cried out to God. And I said, God, if you hear me, I need out. And it was 2 days later, and the FBI did a big sting in Charlotte, and I was one of the ladies that got rescued out. And they've helped set this slave free. And I want that for every victim that's being forced to do this. I want them to be out too. So I know that they need help. I know that they're crying out too.
Wake County Republican Representative Nelson Dollar is one of the state legislators working on the sex trafficking issue.
There are so many people who are still trapped, and you know, it's really it's a power relationship, and many, if not most, of these young women who are trapped in this don't feel there's any way for them to get out of it. I mean, it's a horrible circle, and particularly when you lose hope. You know, I think a long time ago you wouldn't think North Carolina would be have to deal with these kinds of issues. But unfortunately, this is an issue that's on our doorstep, and it is an issue that we have to deal with. We in the General Assembly, our colleagues here, a number of other allied groups, want to see what we can do and what can work to end this scourge of human trafficking and sex trafficking here in North Carolina, and hopefully be the start of a push nationally and really worldwide to end this practice, because it's an inhumane practice. It shouldn't happen anywhere on this globe in the 21st century. And it certainly should not be something that we should have to be dealing with here in a modern country such as the United States. But we are, and we need to take this threat and this problem very seriously.
Another Wake County Republican, Chris Malone, is also leading the latest legislative fight against human sex trafficking.
Human trafficking, and we've heard it here, the word already used, is a form of slavery that can be found throughout the country and unfortunately right here in North Carolina. The perpetrators use power, control, and violence to control these victims in many different forms.
Malone says this is the type of issue lawmakers should address.
That's what we're here for. This is what we're supposed to be doing. This is why we get elected. When we see things, as we spoke earlier today in a meeting, we're 120 out of 9-10 million people, and when these kind of things are brought forward to us, it is our job, it is our duty to stand up and do something that we think makes a difference. We have to get serious about human trafficking, folks. North Carolina can lead the effort by standing up with the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. We are fighting for the most vulnerable North Carolinians, helping victims get on their feet, get the services they need, and become whole again after an incredibly traumatic experience. We are standing up for our neighbors, children, and all those who desperately need someone to interview.
Mecklenburg County Republican Bill Brawley is leading the push on the human trafficking bill.
What we intend to do with this bill is to generate data on what's really on the ground, and also proof of concept to see what works, and also identify the problems that we will have. There will be a second phase, and our second set of goals is to expand this program, or a successor program, statewide, to look at what we can do for penalties for those that perpetrate this evil, and legal rehabilitation for those that have been victimized. And we also want to expand to the other types of human trafficking that are in North Carolina. Like many of the things that we've taken on, whether it's reg reform or taxes, it's not one bill solutions. It's going to take time. We're going to have to watch and learn and adjust and continue to address it. This is a huge industry worldwide, $160 billion. As an entertainment venue, for example, this, if you took World Cup soccer, English Premier League, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, Formula One, and NASCAR combined, they are less than half of this. There are women who are forced to perform sex for money against their will. And in this state, there are boyfriends and husbands and fathers, even of daughters, that are paying for the services these women are providing, fooling themselves into thinking this is a consensual act. It's not. It's rape. Every day in North Carolina, women are being raped for money, and we want to make it stop.
Lawmakers are considering a pilot program costing about $50 million over 2 years. Brantley offered more details.
We are looking at the possibility of 300 women the first year and 600 the second was the base number that we used. I have heard estimates of as many as 16,000 people being trafficked in Mecklenburg County alone. But using several sources of statistics and doing comparative analysis, I think I would estimate there are probably 7,500 prostitutes in the Charlotte metro area alone. If half of them were being trafficked and we managed to get 10% of them out, that would be 350 right there. We think, based on the most, what we think of the statistics in which we have the most confidence, about 1% of the women get out now. We could bring that number in North Carolina up to 3% with this program during the trial. Truth? We don't know. What we do know is there are instances of this. And a concern would be that if a woman tries to get out and we can't help her, and she goes back, she becomes a cautionary tale that scares everyone else.
That's Mecklenburg County Representative Bill Brawley. He's discussing the latest legislative effort to fight human sex trafficking in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. More than 160 public charter schools are now educating more than 90,000 kids in North Carolina. Recently, the State Board of Education approved 14 more charter applications, these for schools that are set to open in 2018. Now, among those 14 is the plan proposed by our next guest, who just happens to be a frequent guest here at Carolina Journal Radio. Of course, we're talking about Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Vice President for Research, also Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, congratulations.
Thank you. Carolina Charter Academy will open in Fuquay-Varina in 2018, and so we were really happy to be able to get approval from the State Board of Education and begin our planning year.
Tell us about the curriculum and what you plan to focus on and bring to kids as an option.
Sure. The school is going to be kindergarten to sixth grade, so we're focusing on elementary and early middle school grades. And the curriculum is going to be core knowledge and Singapore math. So core knowledge is not Common Core. Let me just say that right off the bat.
Okay.
Core knowledge is a was developed by a professor from the University of Virginia who argued that kids needed to know some very basic facts about the world before they can start learning about more complex events and things like that. So it is basically a curriculum that builds year after year, making sure that students have the basic facts about our world, whether it be in geography, history, science, or language arts. And Singapore math has been around for a while now, and it's a way of Providing students a conceptual way of understanding math, it's very successful. Obviously, it's used in Singapore, which has the highest test scores of any nation in mathematics. So we're really excited to be able to partner with Team CFA, a nonprofit organization that helps charter schools like ours get off the ground.
It sounds, Terry, as if you're focusing on the basics, but also rigor.
Absolutely. One of the places where charter schools, some charter schools forget is that while it's great to be free of all the regulations that a traditional public school has to face, with that comes certain responsibilities, and certainly academic rigor is one of them. We're in a very unique position, Carolina Charter Academy, being in Fuquay Varina. Which is in Wake County, but is not what you would envision as Wake County. We're growing very quickly, but there is a large rural component to the town itself. Plus, charter school students can cross county lines. So it's likely that we're going to have students from adjoining counties. So we're not just going to draw from Wake County. We'll be drawing from Harnett County, from Johnston County, and maybe even further away. So we're serving the needs of a region, not just a town here in Wake County.
Now, Terry, of course, as Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation, that means that you are a regular guest here on the program. We talk about education policy all the time. And I wanted to talk to you about this, not just because it's such an incredible personal accomplishment for you to have gotten approval for Carolina Charter Academy, but to talk about the process and the broader discussion. You have told us in the past that it's really, really detailed and cumbersome for folks to try to put together a charter school application, and that can actually prevent a lot of people who have good ideas from participating in the process. So, Spill, what was it like putting this thing together?
Well, my wife was really the one individual that would get everyone together. And it starts with getting a board, establishing a nonprofit board of people that share a vision about what a school could be. And honestly, we assembled our first board and then disbanded because there was no consensus on that board of what the school should be, who it should serve, what kind of curriculum it should use. So we were sort of discouraged there at first, and we're talking about 2 years ago is when this process started. And so we got some new individuals involved. We had a shared vision, and we looked for some partner that we can that would give us some support along the way, and that was Team CFA for us. When it came to the application itself was 63 pages along with 125 pages of appendices. So it is an enormous amount of work to get the application together because you have to describe every aspect of the school. You have to talk about everything from operations to curricula to teachers, administrators, what kind of salaries are going to be provided. I mean, every aspect of the school has to be detailed in that application. That application, along with a $1,000 application fee, goes to the Charter School Advisory Board. And that advisory board goes through those applications with a fine-tooth comb. They find every little mistake, every little inconsistency, and charter schools have an opportunity to respond to what they find in that initial examination of the application.
In fact, if you want to go forward, you have to respond to their questions and give them satisfactory answers.
That's right. So once we give them all those answers on paper, then you have to go before the board for the first initial interview. And that initial interview, if they believe that you have everything in place and that you have a solid board, goes on, they will grant you to the full interview. So basically there are two interviews with the Charter School Advisory Board. Not all schools advance to the interview stages. Some schools don't advance to the second interview stage. But I can tell you that standing in front of the Charter School Advisory Board, where they fire questions off to members of the board that must be answered within about an hour, is very difficult. The cross-examination that they provide charter school applicants is probably second to none, because these are all charter school operators. They understand what makes a successful charter school, and so when they're asking you questions, they want to make sure that the applicant, which was myself, my wife, and the members of the board, have a good plan in place and have leadership in place that's going to make the school successful.
It sounds very complex and not for the faint of heart, but here's what I think is really fascinating. You said early on that initially you disbanded the group of people because you couldn't agree on things. Did that end up, Terry, really ensuring that you had a very fine, specific focus and an agreement on exactly what the path forward was going to be for this school?
Yeah, I think it was actually a good thing that we were able to figure out exactly which way we wanted to go for this school, who we wanted to serve, and where we would locate. And our board is made up of parents, and parents have very different ideas about what they want a school to be. Not only that, they want a school for their own children, and sometimes what they want for their children is not what an entire school should be focused on. So that was one of the initial difficulties. And one of the things about charter school boards is that they represent people from every sector, the public sector, the private sector, nonprofit sector. We have two teachers on our board. We have a college professor. We have an individual who has a tutoring company. So we have a great cross-section of folks on our board. And although we don't always agree, no board ever agrees on everything, I think that the effort that we've made to ensure that Carolina Charter Academy is successful is really encouraging. And now the fun begins, our planning year, leading up to our opening in 2018.
And it's called Carolina Charter Academy. And lastly, Terry, just give us a sense across North Carolina. Are we seeing charters in every county of the state, or are there pockets where they're very, very popular and other pockets where they just haven't developed yet?
Yeah, they're definitely popular around our urban cores of Mecklenburg County and Wake County. And we could use a lot more charter schools in some of our rural and disadvantaged communities in the northeastern part of the state.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Vice President for Research, Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.